everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy Tom Fairbanks. Tom, taking a look at the radar here, because I was curious. We usually don't have these kind of high cloudy days, so I was thinking this might hinder the thunderstorm development. What's your take?
Well, the prediction is about a 20% chance, so yeah. You're probably right about that. We'll have a little better chance tomorrow and on through into next week.
Okay.
Only about a 30 to 40% chance, though.
All right. It is August, and that means we're actually kind of getting close to the midway point of the summer thunderstorm season. It's the Buckmaster Show. It is midweek edition, Wednesday, August 7th. 2024, we'll begin our 15th year already in January of our radio program. We come to you from the Green Things Zocalo Village studio, which is part of the Bustos Media operations here in town. And I point out that really growing operation. We've got 5 radio stations now under one roof. The latest acquisition, 101.7 The Drive, which is celebrating this week their 5-year anniversary. They've been part of the Bustos Media Group for about a year, and they're doing very well. Very popular radio station. But this one's KVOI, The Voice. We have our worldwide live listening. That means you can listen to the program anywhere, as long as you've got your computer, at buckmastershow.com. Also very proud that every show we do, we put up, thanks to my assistant, Rosemary, we put up our programs usually by about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, so they're available on podcast. Then they go into the archive, and we've got an extensive archive dating back to our first week in January of 2011 when we began the radio program. Our live line for our telephone interviews that is presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. We're going to begin today with the second part of our 2-day discussion. I wanted to do 2 days on this because it's such an important issue, and the issue is water sustainability in Arizona. Joining me back in studio, he was kind enough to be with us yesterday and come down again to the station today, agronomist Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, the Buckmaster Show contributor on agriculture, and he is a professor and extension, agriculture extension specialist in agronomy and soil science at the University of Arizona Department of Environmental Science, which is part of the College of Agriculture, Life, and Veterinary Science and Cooperative Extension at the U of A. Jeff didn't get off the bus yesterday here in Tucson. He's been around about as long as I have. I came in January of 88, my second visit to Tucson, second time living here. Jeff came, beat me by pretty much a year. He is widely recognized as one of the best in the business. He's a fellow for both the American Society of Agronomy and Soil Science Society of America. Hey, Jeff, thanks for coming back today.
My pleasure. Good to see you, Bill.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on what you were talking about. If you ask the average Arizonan, how much water do you think you use a day? Probably people would say maybe 30 gallons, something like that. But as you pointed out yesterday, it can be as much as 1,500 gallons a day.
That's just the water that we, through the food that we consume. There's actually 3 parts of this that's interesting to consider. One would be how much water, wet water, we use. That's what we would normally think about.
Yeah.
But the water that we would consume
the
would
shower,
be the wet water. Showers, yeah. The port we, you know, drink out of the faucet, you know, et cetera, et cetera, mm. The wet water. And that comes out to Arizona Department of Water Resources says the average Arizonan is using about 146 gallons a day. Mm. And so that first is the first kind of shocker that comes to people. But then yeah. The second part, and that's usually, by the way, we think about wet water, where it's what we're usually talking about in terms of water conservation, water sustainability. Obviously, it's something that's tangible to us. And we do have to manage that. And that's very important to us in the state. We use about 7.1 million acre feet of water. Now, an acre foot is an acre of land, which is about the size of a football field, approximately about 1 foot deep in depth. And again, mm-hmm. That volume is considered as 1 acre foot. Mm-hmm. We use in Arizona totally, and that's with about 7.4 million people in the state today, about 7.1 million acre feet a year. Mm-hmm. And put that in perspective, we have a 2.8 million acre foot allocation from the Colorado River that we've been, you know, working with. So you go back then and say, well, how much water do we use in this state? We use what, 7.1 million acre feet of water. And what does all that involve? That's wet water we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. But another part of our daily consumption comes through the food we eat. And then a third part of our daily consumption comes through all of the products that we use, or non-edible products, clothing, cars, computers, smartphones, et cetera, et cetera. But you just look at the food that we eat, and the average person will consume enough food to basically, it takes about 800 to 1,500 or 2,000 gallons of water a day to produce the food that we eat. And that's where you get into the big one. And myself working in agriculture, that's kind of a hinge point in the discussion about water and how we produce crops, what we eat, and how we support ourselves.
Yeah, and you're producing, I've got an advanced copy of it for the industry, a fascinating piece titled American Perspectives on Personal Water Requirements. One thing you point out in this article about one, to make one pair of jeans, this is unbelievable. A pair of jeans requires 2,600 gallons to make.
Right.
And a cotton t-shirt, which we're all, you know, wearing, I've got a cotton polo on, that's 713 gallons.
Right.
And Tom Fairbanks on the other side of the glass, Tom, that shirt, yeah, your polo there, over 700 gallons. But I'll tell you, the thing that really jumps out is when you think about gallons in industry. We've got this semiconductor microchip production, a huge couple of them coming up to the West Valley up in Phoenix. These numbers are just astounding. The water, what is it, the monthly, to make 40,000 wafers monthly of the little chips would consume nearly 5 million gallons of water daily.
Right. And a lot of that has to be ultra-pure water, so they have to purify that water in addition to that. And you add that all up, and one of those plants will use, like we talk about, that acre feet.
Yeah.
This is a good point, because a plant like that, at that rate, would use 15 acre feet a day. And we think about it, we criticize, well, we hear people criticizing crop production in this state.
Yeah.
And we say, well, it uses all this cotton, for example, that typically comes up. We had a question on that yesterday.
Yes, we did.
And so it's a good point, a good legitimate question. Well, how much water does that use? Well, cotton plants, cotton crop will use about five acre feet per year, per season, five to six max, but usually about four. Right now, it's about 3 to 4 acre feet. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about 15 acre feet per day. And you add that all up, it's 4,000 acre feet per year on these chip plants.
Yeah,
so, I mean, it just puts it in perspective. What it takes to grow our crops, to produce our products like the shirts we wear, we're talking about that. That's where it comes from, important. And then there's the manufacturing costs of water that goes along with it. But just kind of puts things in perspective about, it takes a lot of water to produce our food. Yes, it takes water to grow plants and to grow animals. It takes water to support life. Mm-hmm. But it also takes a lot of water to support a lot of other things around us in life that we take for granted. We don't think about the water footprint that goes with that.
So the obvious question, when we're talking about the microchip developers, how are we going to come up with that kind of water?
It has to come out of the water budget that we have.
My goodness.
And it either comes from surface water or groundwater. And so you go back again to the surface water. The big source that we have in the state is the Colorado River, which is suffering from shortages associated with the drought, over 23 years of drought. And our base allocation in Goodyear in Arizona is 2.8 million acre feet. The difference in that 7.1 million acre feet that we use every year comes from groundwater. And there is where we have a big discussion today, is about how do we sustain this groundwater supply, particularly with almost 7.5 million people. I think it's 7.4 million people in Arizona right now. And so we're putting pressures on our resources under drought conditions and under continued growth. So we're really at a point where it's important for us all to think about, what does it take to support life in the desert?
Mm-hmm. And then there's a huge electricity component also with
the
microchip.
Absolutely. Area. We always say there's a nexus with food, energy, and water.
Yeah.
And energy and water are definitely connected. For example, we take water out of the Colorado River and we lift it almost 2,600 feet from the from the Colorado River across central Arizona up to Tucson, basically the Avra Valley. So that takes a lot of energy to lift that water. But everywhere we go, there's an intimate connection in water use, water movement, and energy production.
And a listener pointed out that the Palo Verde nuclear plant uses just a huge amount of water every year to cool it down.
Right, yeah, right. Like, yeah, there's a good example there, too. It's a good example of why there's that connection between water and energy production. And we not only have folks that I know that work in the energy business here in the state will tell me we not only have a water drought, we have an energy drought.
Yeah.
And so we're pushing our limits. And it's something I think about all the time living here in Arizona. I kind of like the air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, like, turn on the lights in here and run this show. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of power to support us as well.
All right, we'll take a break right here. More with Professor Silver, too, some fascinating things to think about when it comes to water and sustainability of water in our desert environment. Be right back.
Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com. Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is finalizing a new 20-year plan for RTA board review and approval to seek public feedback on the draft plan. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in a diverse culture while wandering through bustling markets, sampling exotic cuisines, or forging connections with people from all walks of life? Well, Bon Voyage Travel is here to plan your perfect journey. Whether you're setting off on a solo expedition, embarking on a group adventure, or simply dreaming of far-off destinations, we can help create your custom experience. The road ahead is filled with endless possibilities. Visit bvtravel.com to find your specialized Bon Voyage Travel advisor today.
Quality of Life Research Center has conducted more than 100 clinical trials in Arizona over its 20-year history. Because of their success, participants may have access to a variety of treatments under study that may not be available to people outside the trial. And participants may receive compensation for study-related time and travel. If you think you'd like to participate in a clinical trial, please visit QLMC.com to view our open trials and express interest.
Welcome back. Jeff Silvertooth is with us, University of Arizona agronomist. We're doing a two-part, two-day discussion on water sustainability, and it came up during the break. Tom, actually, our wonderful engineer-producer, came in and asked you a question about recycling of some of this water, not only at the chip facilities, but the nuclear facilities.
Right. Some of that can be recycled, but the big loss that we have associated with the nuclear plants and power, you know, plants like that, is that the nuclear reactor heats up water, and the water, the steam from that water, turns turbines, and a lot of that then goes off as vapor into the air. Mm-hmm. So it's not lost completely; it stays in the hydrosphere, but it doesn't necessarily come right back down to us as wet water. Now, in some cases, they have condensation facilities where they can condense some of that steam and bring it back and recycle it. So I'm not an engineer, a nuclear engineer, so I wouldn't be able to elaborate on that. But that's where the loss comes from, is from the steam generation.
Can you envision a day where we'll have a number here in Arizona that will be sustainable, and anything more will not be?
In terms of people,
yeah,
population?
I mean, that's kind of a big question a lot of people think about.
Right. There are limits. There are finite limits
that's,
to a
That's
to
a, what I'm saying. Are there limits?
Absolutely, there are. The question is, where does that limit exist? We had a point yesterday that you brought up, Bill, that is a relevant point to this discussion, and that is, some folks say, well, since we use 70% of our water in this state goes to agriculture. If we just eliminated production agriculture, we'd have plenty of water.
Yeah.
Well, in a simplistic analysis, that's true. But then also, too, you have to think, it takes water to produce food, and what we do in Arizona with that water for agriculture is we contribute that to what we would call our basic food supply in the nation. The truth of it is, we import more water through food that we consume than what we produce. You know, so then you think, well, it has to have some water in the state allocated to agriculture to support the people, at least to do our share. And you think then, in terms of the efficiencies that we have with water movement, with the energy production, et cetera, there are finite limits. You know, there's some interesting discussions about that today in terms of what are those limits. There's some theories about it. People will sometimes say, well, we can do a lot better in the future as technology improves. But there's a point with which we have to maintain the technology advancements in relation to and our own conservation capacities as a population, in relation to our resources that are available to us. And that's particularly important now, in the past 23 years, where we've been having limited or reduced water supplies because of the drought. So it brings us right back to this kind of a crossover nexus that a lot of us really believe in environmental science, that we're approaching that crossroads pretty fast.
Do you want to close the loop on another topic yesterday about foreign entities coming into our state and using our water? Not only foreign, but you pointed out, I believe, the name of the company, Riverview Dairy in Minneapolis.
Right. Riverview Dairy is a large dairy company based up in Minnesota, and they have dairies around the country. They have a large one in southeast Arizona, Cochise County.
Yes.
And that's the facility in question. Now, they've expanded this facility quite remarkably. They've also put in a lot of new wells, deep wells. And so the concerns have been in the Cochise County area, is that if companies like that can come in and they become somewhat vilified, if they can come in and just open up these lands and punching in new wells, and they're depleting the aquifer, depleting the water supplies at a faster rate than ever before.
That is a concern.
Concern. It's a legit concern. But the thing is, too, with Riverview and companies like them, they're not doing anything against the law. It's not doing anything wrong, I mean, legally. And so they're just basically exercising their rights as a company. They have the capital and the wherewithal to do so. The point we made yesterday, and it probably is worthy of emphasis, would be, if Arizonans don't like that and we need to do something different, well, that requires legislation. We have to recognize the fact, too, that our water laws in the state for groundwater in rural areas is pretty much wide open to the old Wild West 19th century. If you and I own a piece of land, we can punch a well and we can pull out all the water we want. There's no measurement of how much we're taking out. There's no limits.
We could have changed that in 1980 when we put the requirements on the urban water, but we left rural wide open.
That was with the Groundwater Management Act of 1980. That was remarkable that it was done, but it did put those limits primarily on the urban areas of the state. This last year, in the last legislature, there was a lot of effort that was taking place. I heard your interview last week with Attorney General Mays.
Yes, on Friday.
Yeah, and they were saying that, well, nothing was done. No, there was quite a lot done. It's just that it's a difficult problem to come to an agreement with, and I think enough progress was made, hopefully, from what I understand from the parties that have been participating in those negotiations, to come back this next session, and hopefully they can reach an agreement. Our governor really wants that to be done. Of course, she's a Democratic governor working with a Republican Senate and a Republican House. But interestingly enough, the chair of the Natural Resource Committee of in the House of Representatives is from Cochise County. It's Representative Gail Griffin.
Mm-hmm.
And she is the chair of the Natural Resource Committee. So any bill, any discussions that are going to be heard for the House of Representatives in our state will have to go through Representative Griffin's committee to do so.
Tom has a two-part question. Is Arizona water treated as a commodity, and do we sell it to other interests outside of the state?
Not directly. That's a good question. There's been a lot of discussion about some colleagues of mine around here that advocate pretty strongly that if we could solve a lot of our water problems if we commoditize it, so people pay more for it, put it on a competitive market. And so there's a lot of discussion about it. A lot of economists and attorneys have had different points of view on that are quite interesting. Right now, not necessarily, we don't really put a commodity pump market on the water. So in a direct answer to the question, no, not now, but there's some interest in that.
All right, let's transition to how are we doing on the Colorado River.
Right now, the projections are right now this month, the Bureau of Reclamation will come out with their operational plans for 2025. And what we anticipate from that will be, we'll still be at what we call operational levels of Tier 1 for the drought contingency plan. Tier 1 basically takes our 2.8 million acre foot allocation and reduces that by 512,000 acre feet. And we've been dealing with that reduction for the past year. We had dealt with it a couple of years ago. And a couple of years ago, we were actually on Tier 2 levels, and we were losing 592,000 acre-feet of our allocation on the river. In the meantime, that's what we anticipate to happen, is go into these Tier 1 reductions for 2025. So the reservoirs are fairly stable right now. They're still low, but they're relatively stable. They aren't, critical to moving us into like Tier 2 reductions. The big issue on the Colorado River right now are the negotiations to bring us into the new agreements that will take place in 2026. And that has to be resolved really in the next year. There are two proposals that are in with the federal government right now. The basin states weren't able to come to an agreement this last year. The federal government, the Bureau of Reclamation, Department of Interior said they wanted proposals in by March. One proposal came in from the Lower Basin. The Lower Basin got their act together, amazingly, and mm-hmm. put one proposal in. And then the Upper Basin put in an opposition.
And we're in the Lower Basin.
We're in the Lower Basin, yeah. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. And that basin is divided at Lee's Ferry, right below Glen Canyon Dam. Mm-hmm. But right now, that's the point of contention, is the Upper Basin's... Interesting points there, Bill. The Upper Basin's contending they don't like the way everything's been done for the past 100 years with the Colorado River Compact and what we call collectively the law of the river. And they say on one hand, we want to redo the whole thing. We throw it all out the window. Well, that's all the laws that go with that's going to mean lawsuits. That's going to take mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. The other hand, they'll say, well, the law of the river says we're supposed to have this much water, X amount of water, and we haven't had it. And then they say they want to support the law of the river. Well, the law of the river also says very clearly they need to release collectively over 10 years 75 million acre feet. That's 7.5 million acre feet a year on the average, which is our lower basin allocation. So it's interesting, a little bit of dichotomy there. But my colleagues that are actually participating on those negotiating panels say the sticking point is the Upper Basin, and particularly the state of Colorado right now, they say. So that where that ends up, I don't know. I'm afraid it's going to end up with some litigation. That means that takes some long time. And that means the federal government will step in and just basically dictate to us what's going to happen.
If you're a young person thinking of a job in the law, water law might be a great way to go. Let's see if we can have you answer a listener question about why does it seem, this listener asks, are the Republicans opposed, as was evident in this last legislative session, why are they opposed to water legislation changes? What's your take on that?
Interesting question. Very good question. Thank you. This is my observations, from where my seat is as an agronomist with the university working here, over 40 years. And I work with people on both sides of the aisle out mm-hmm. of the state, obviously. This last session where the question is actually directed to the Republicans sponsored, we mentioned Representative Gail Griffin as from Cochise County. She's the chair of the Natural Resource Committee in the House. She and the senator for the Natural Resource, chair of the Natural Resource Committee in the Senate, Asine Kerr. She is from a dairy family in around the Buckeye area in Maricopa County. Together, they authored some legislation. It was Senate Bill SB 1221. Now they were trying to put forth legislation to put some regulation in place. The questions were that was challenged by some people, particularly on the other side of the aisle, but other folks in agriculture too, saying they didn't agree with the tenets of that bill, and that's where they offered another bill in opposition to that, and that's where the gridlock took place, was in the negotiations and disagreements about how, if we're going to regulate, it's a question of how we're going to do it and how much. And so it wasn't that they were totally opposed to regulation, but it was the question of how and how much and who has to decide. There's some interesting points associated with that. But in basic answer to the listener's question, which is a good one, that's basically it. They were trying, they just couldn't agree to how that would be done.
Why couldn't they agree? Just financial interests?
It was a lot of basic stuff. You know, okay. Like how much are you going to give people rights from what they would say grandfathered rights? There was a lot of discussion. It was primarily a lot of argument within the ag community. It's a good point, too, I might say, that there was a lot of people that came out from one side or the other saying, all the ag community says this. That wasn't necessarily true from my perspective.
They don't speak with one voice in many cases, right? Not right now.
And they need to get that worked out. The ag community does.
All right. But, Jeff Silvertooth, out of time, but great discussion over the past 2 days. We'll see you in about a month. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
All right. It's the midway point of the Buckmaster Show, the midweek edition. Take a break right here. We're going to have our Reed Park Zoo update. Always fun to find out what's going on out at the zoo right after this.
Dine in or take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana. Plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com. The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The News and Sun's media reach 75% of the region through newspapers, websites, social media, video, newsletters, and more. They also produce more than a dozen print and digital magazines annually for an audience of 70,000. Find them at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, covering your hometown.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things, Zocalo Village Studios. The following segment presented by our friends at the Reed Park Zoo. The zoo was founded in 1965 by the then City of Tucson Parks Director Gene Reed as an exhibit of exotic birds. The zoo has become one of America's top zoos. Over 300 animals from all over the world call the zoo home, and probably more than a half million visitors come out to the zoo annually. With us on the live line is Deborah Carr, the Director of Marketing and Communications at the Reed Park Zoo. Hey, Deborah, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for asking. You know, we know that the animals at the Reed Park Zoo come in, all ages, and they all have their special care needs. Recently, I understand you had an animal receiving some care that was a little bit different, acupuncture.
That's right. So we do look at the quality of life is tantamount for any animal here at the zoo, whether they are just born or all the way up to senior care. And we had a goat. We have a goat named Ari. She is a Hopper Silly goat, which would be native to Switzerland area. And she's about 8 years old, out of a life expectancy of about 10 years. So as over the years, she was the team observed that she wasn't getting around as well. She was having some trouble with her legs and pain in her joints and what have you. And they had tried a lot of traditional Western care, if mm-hmm. you will, medications, massage, laser treatments, and they didn't seem to be working. So they wanted her to have the best quality of life and to get back to being her usual active self. So we turned to acupuncture, an ancient Eastern treatment. It's been around for about 5,000 years, actually, and had a local doctor come in. She's a certified veterinary acupuncturist, Dr. Lauren Genow. And of course, you know, the zoo shares expertise out with various other groups and zoos, as well as brings in experts when we need to. That's exactly what happens. So Dr. Genow has been administering these acupuncture treatments to Ari. So she gets these little needles that are inserted at various points in the body, and it actually interrupts pain signals and helps to relieve her joint pain and inflammation. And it also, not surprisingly, releases endorphins.
Yeah.
Which help her relax. So we found that she just really enjoys these. She loves human touch and human interaction. So she actually has a lot of a chill out period when she goes in for these acupuncture treatments. And they've been working really well. So she's been regaining mobility and has been jumping around the habitat and has even been able to come off of some of the medications.
Well, so, I know it has worked for me, a little bit of arthritis in my index fingers. I've gone through acupuncture, so I think I understand where the animal is coming from.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. You know, you never quite know how they're going to react, but she's just really, really relaxed, and it's done wonders for her.
So we have over on the elephant side of things, the your elephant habitat and really doing very well. And talk a little bit about elephant care. We've got one elephant reaching a milestone and another young elephant that was born this year.
That's right. Well, we opened our new and improved elephant habitat in 2012. It's been recognized as one of the best in the country. And we do work with our elephants to provide positive reward training. They can choose to participate in their health care. So they get things like they can participate in blood draws and different studies and things, and we can use and share that information out with other zoos as well as researchers in the wild. And Nandi, as you just mentioned, was the very first elephant born here at the zoo in 2014. She came from two parents who were rescued from a culling situation in the wild, and she's just been a beloved addition to the zoo and a beloved community member here in Tucson since since her birth. We're going to be celebrating her 10th birthday, as well as World Elephant Day on August 17th, which is going to call attention to these majestic animals and what is happening with them in the wild. They've since become, you know, very endangered, and we will be talking about some of the steps that people can take, as well as things that the zoo is doing to help protect these animals in the wild. But Nandi, just some fun things about Nandi. She has really grown into her adulthood, and we do have the new baby, Maru, who's 5 months old. And Nandi has really kind of taken it upon herself to be like a second mother to Maru. She is very protective of her, showing her the ropes, really demonstrating what a great mom she's going to be someday.
You know, you mentioned a lot of the research going on with elephants. Give us a quick word about a little bit more on what the zoo's doing in that regards to help not only our elephants, but perhaps other elephants, not only in zoos, but in the wild.
Exactly. Well, there's a disease called EEHV. It's a type of herpes virus, and it can be very fatal to elephants, young and old. It's quite common in the wild as well as in human care. So the zoo for years has been participating with other zoos to not only provide, you know, cross data that can be shared, but also to develop a blood bank of sorts. So we cross type and build this blood bank that can be used in treatments both for our elephant should they ever get the virus, or to share blood with another zoo whose elephant may be in danger. So it's really important when an animal does have this EEHV that you get blood and plasma to them very quickly. It can be a matter of life and death. So currently, also to be very proactive, our zoo is drawing plasma from one of our older elephants, and that is a good match for Penzi, one of our younger elephants. And so we'll be able to bank that plasma to have on hand, which will be very handy should we ever need to use it. And then also, in addition to the EEHV work that we do, the zoo does support a program, a field program in the wild that is done by Dr. Charles Foley. It is saving acreage for safe passage of the elephants during their migrations, helps keep them from encroaching in human areas, and also to avoid being poached. And to date, we have helped to preserve over 1 million acres in safe passage for these elephants.
Good. So that's
very happy about that.
That's wonderful news. Deborah Carr is with us, Director of Marketing and Communication, Reed Park Zoo. Of course, the zoo is such a great learning area for children, and the teachers love to take the kids to the zoo, and you recently had Teacher Appreciation Weekend at the zoo. Do you have some specific programs, Deborah, for the kids this year?
Yeah, and we'd like to, you know, just let the community know that as part of the sales tax funding that the zoo receives, we do offer free self-guided field trips to all area schools, K through 12. That includes the Title I schools. So it gives really a chance to come and visit the zoo and to learn. And we do have also some materials that, you know, are STEM education, meet some education requirements for all the classrooms. They study habitats, conservation, adaptations, all different types of things for animals that are very useful. We also have an outreach program where we can literally bring part of the zoo to you with some of our ambassador animals, and that is offered to both schools and groups throughout the community. And if you, if teachers are looking for something maybe a little more in-depth, we do offer behind-the-scenes tours and some educator-led tours. Those do have a little bit of cost associated with those, but we do have a variety of programs, as well as regular education programs that focus on, you know, being a zoo vet for the day or learning how to care for different types of animals here at the zoo. So a lot of things that we offer to teachers, and they can always go onto our website and look under our education tab to get more information.
Deborah, before we let you go, there's always a lot of activities wrapping up summer here, getting into fall. You had recently a first responder day. What's going on? What's coming up?
Well, actually, we're coming up on our First Responders Day. That's going to be September 28th. So we will have free admission for first responders and dollar admission for up to six of their family members. And that's a way that we can thank our first responders for all that they do to keep our community safe and healthy. And we also are planning, we have our last summer safari night of the year. They'll take place this Saturday. That's from 6 to 8 p.m. here at the zoo. So you can come out and enjoy the zoo in cooler temperatures. This week we'll be focusing on our South American area and all of the animals there. And we have special music and all types of activities that will tie back into that theme. And then, of course, tickets have gone live, and we're preparing for the zoo's biggest fundraiser of the year, which is ZooSon. That's going to be coming up on October 4th. If you've never been, it's a great time to come experience the zoo at twilight. And we have a variety, over 30 different restaurants and beverage partners throughout the community and regionally that come in and share up samples of their food for one ticket price. We also have music, very unique auctions with animal art to all sorts of trips and jewelry and homewares and baskets, and it provides support for the zoo, both for our conservation programs, education programs, animal habitat improvements, and operations for the zoo.
All right. People can find out more about the zoo, what's going on over there at reedparkzoo.org. And before we go, congratulations to the zoo on the official green certification, so that the sustainability programs have been noticed and you've got that green certification, which is terrific.
Absolutely. We're very proud of that. And it looked at everything from water audits to electricity to green building materials. So something it's very near and dear to our hearts and central to our mission here at the zoo is sustainability and conservation. So, and we also are celebrating our highest attended year ever at the zoo.
Good.
Last year. So, and looking ahead to our 60th anniversary this
year. Very cool. Deborah Carr, always a pleasure. Thanks, Deborah.
Thanks so much, Bill.
All right. We'll take a break right here. Mitch Tobin, our environmental reporter, is coming up next. We'll hear from Mitch after this.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation improvements in the region, averaging more than $100 million in tax revenue each year. The RTA is preparing a new 20-year plan for public review prior to a May 2025 election. Sign up at rtanext.com for updates.
Quality of Life Medical Center has served Tucson residents for more than 20 years. We understand the key to a long, healthy life is not just about getting the right medical treatment, but it's also about feeling good mentally and emotionally. Whether you're looking for preventative care or treatment for a specific condition, we're here for you. And we are accepting new patients for primary care, pain management, and sexual health. Please visit QLMC.com to request an appointment. Quality of Life. Our name says it all.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show. We send a lot of listeners this time of year, especially over to Silver City, to cool off the elevation 5,000 to 7,000 feet, a beautiful area of the Land of Enchantment. It's 84 degrees right now, midday over in Silver City, only about a three-hour drive east of Tucson. It's going to be 10 degrees, 10, even 15 degrees cooler over there because of the elevation. Start your planning for your road trip to Silver City by visiting southwestnewmexico.org. Our contributor on the environment is Mitch Tobin, the co-director of the Water Desk. That's an independent journalism initiative based at the University of Colorado Boulder, the Center for Environmental Journalism, focusing on Western water issues, especially the Colorado River and Rio Grande. Mitch's latest project, it's a fun one. I enjoy getting it. It's a free newsletter titled Snow News. Mitch is an informer environmental reporter with the Napa Valley Register, Tucson Citizen, Arizona Daily Star, author of the book Endangered, Showing Why So Many Species Are at Risk of Extinction. And Mitch joins us right now on the live line from his home base in Colorado. Hey, Mitch, how are you?
I'm doing great, Bill. Thanks so much for inviting me on the show.
Well, it was fun in the latest edition of Snow News for those of us who are very much thinking about, and we should be, climate change and a warmer Earth. You remind us that there were two different periods in the Earth's history when basically it was snowball Earth.
Yeah, quite different back then. We're talking a really long time ago, like 600, 700 million years ago. So there were these periods in Earth's history that scientists have nicknamed Snowball Earth because it got so incredibly cold that the whole planet, or maybe nearly the entire planet, the surface froze. And, you know, looked at from space, it would have appeared to be this giant snowball orbiting the sun. You know, it may seem like very irrelevant given that we're always talking nowadays about global warming, but it's very much tied to greenhouse gases and the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and also something called the albedo feedback, which is this very important feedback loop in our climate system. And basically, if you get more and more ice on the planet, that reflects more and more sunlight. And so it is not absorbed by the Earth. And so the planet gets colder, and then there's more ice, and then there's more reflectivity, and so on. You know, the thing is, today, we're running that loop in reverse. And so as we melt more snow and ice, especially at the poles and the Arctic and the Antarctica regions, that causes the Earth to absorb more heat, and it gets warmer, which leads to more melting, less reflectivity, more absorption of that energy from the sun, and it just feeds on itself. It's a vicious circle. And so I thought it was fun to just sort of look way back into the Earth's history as a break from the summer heat. But, you know, even though it was the sort of polar opposite of the situation we're dealing with now, it's really the same processes at work, just going in reverse.
And one final item about that, volcanic activity is really the key there and helps explain the whole life cycle of Snowball Earth, right?
Yeah, so people wonder, well, if the entire planet was frozen over, why did it not stay that way? And the idea that most scientists argue for is that the volcanic activity, still plate tectonics and things like that. And so eventually that carbon dioxide was able to be emitted and grew to very, very high concentrations, you know, much higher than we're dealing with today. And so that was able to then melt the planet and was able to get us out of that, you know, very cold period.
You know, looking at the fires in the West, this has become a trend, unfortunately. It seems like now they're starting earlier. It used to be August. Now it's like late June, July, and the smoke and air quality is really becoming a huge issue in many parts of the country in the summer because of this, Mitch Tobin.
It is, and I think, you know, it's interesting that very often we're dealing with smoke here from fires that are very far away. And, you know, earlier this summer, we had a lot of fires in Canada that were sending all of that smoke down here. And, you know, there's been an increasing amount of attention focused on this air quality issue and more research showing that it really has very negative impacts on public health. And it can be from fires that are very far away, and that smoke really travels, you know, great distances. And so, you know, right now, California still has this Park fire burning, which is one of the largest in state history. Here in Colorado, we had a spate of wildfires along the Front Range near Denver. Thankfully, those seem to be getting under control. But you're right. I mean, there is a very clear trend toward increased fire activity in the West. Part of that is certainly due to climate change, things getting hotter, drier, the snowpack going away earlier. But also there is, you know, the land management angle and the fact that we've been suppressing fires in some places for more than a century. And so there's a tremendous amount of fuel that has built up, and that's a big part of it as well. And so, no real end in sight to that problem, it seems.
The summer rainy season, of course, here, a.k.a. monsoon, we'll have areas that have been pretty productive. Then we have areas like over at Safford up in northeastern Arizona have had virtually no rain. It's pretty typical, I guess, of the monsoon, but you don't get a uniform coverage. But there are areas still in drought, certainly in our coverage area.
Yeah, there's definitely parts of the Southwest and parts of the West more broadly that are still in drought. And you're right that the monsoon tends to be very, very spotty in that it can be pouring in one location and, you know, a quarter mile away, the sun is shining and there's no precipitation at all. And that's just the nature of the beast, that these are convective thunderstorms and they just tend to drop rain in certain locations and bypass others. That's just kind of the nature of the beast, but thankfully it sounds like the monsoon is going to start up again. At least here in Southwest Colorado, we're expecting more rain. But it's been a weird year, a weird summer here. I mean, it was very rainy here in June, which is unusual. It's typically very dry, just like it is down in Tucson at that time of the year. But then we've gone through a real dry stretch, and, you know, every season is different, but I think the monsoon is just inherently unpredictable as to who's going to get rain and who doesn't.
Quick couple of thoughts on the situation with our reservoirs, Mitch Tobin.
Well, you know, this last year was decent as far as the snowpack, and so there was some recovery in reservoirs, and the problem didn't really get much worse. But the challenge is that, you know, we've been dealing with this mega drought that is, you know, almost 25 years old. And so we need a number of wet seasons in a row in order to reverse that. And so there are still now ongoing negotiations related to the Colorado River and how the declining flows in that river are going to impact water use in the Southwest, and essentially how the states are going to come to some type of agreement as to how to share the pain of reduced water. That negotiation is still ongoing. I think the hope among the negotiators and the water managers in the region is to try to wrap that up before there's a new administration in the White House.
Okay.
But it's very unclear whether they'll come to an agreement by then.
All right, Mitch, we're going to have to let you go. Folks can Google Snow News. It's a free newsletter. I want to wish you all the best. We'll talk to you soon. Mitch Tobin, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
All right, that's going to do it. On behalf of Mitch Tobin and Tom on the other side of the glass, Bill Buckmaster wishing everybody well.